moved his lips. "Nine," he said bitterly. "That's what the horoscope said. We can only pray it's for the best." "Lord," said Whitey number two, "that's what I call a 9-to-1 prayer. Fawnin', now you've went and made a president out of a sow's ear. How about getting Doc's paper wrote?" "Who's a sow's ear?" Hazel demanded. "William Henry Harrison."
"Oh,"
said Hazel.
"Oh, yeah."
Agnes piped up in her hoarse soprano.
"Doc just ain't himself. I took him a pint, and he didn't hardly pass the time of day. Just sat there looking at that yellow paper. Know what was on that paper?"
"Eggs," said Whitey number one.
"No, I don't like to tell. It ain't nice."
"Hot damn," said Mac.
"Maybe he's getting well. Go on, what?"
"Well," said Agnes in a shocked voice, "he drew a picture of a lady without no clothes on, and right beside that was one of them damn devilfish, only it was smoking a pipe. Don't hardly seem like the old Doc."
Wide-eyed, she shook herself out of a mountainous lethargy. "He used to be the easy-goingest guy in the world. Now he's got a wild hair. Anybody else but Doc, I'd figure it was a dame. But hell, Doc can take dames or let 'em alone." Mac said, "He could even take dames and let 'em alone." Fauna put her hands on her hips. "You fellas sure there ain't a girl hiding out where he can't get to her?"
"No," said Hazel. "I wished he'd snap out of it. Go over and talk to him, and he don't say nothing, and he don't listen."
"Let's run a few dames past him and see if he picks up," said Whitey number two. Mac said, "I don't believe in it, but I wish Fauna would do a job on Doc. Might give us an idea." Fauna said, "I never seen nobody that wanted me to do a horoscope that believed in it. I ain't sure I believe in it myself. Sure I'll do Doc. When's his birthday?" With surprise, they realized that no one could remember. "Seems like it was in autumn," said Eddie.
"Got to have it," Fauna said. "Mac, you think you could find out?"
"I guess so. Say, Fauna, if you ain't got too much integrity, could you maybe rig it a little?"
"How do you mean?"
"Well, kind of tell him to lay off his goddamn paper and get back to horsing around."
"What's wrong with his paper if only he gets it wrote?" Hazel demanded.
Mac scratched his stomach. "I guess we gotta face it," he said. "Doc wants to write that crazy paper, driving himself nuts with it. Know what I think? Doc ain't never gonna write that paper."
Hazel stood up.
"What do you mean?"
"Well, you know what kind of people they call accident-prone. No matter what they do, they get hurt. It's like they want accidents. Well, I think Doc don't really want to write that paper."
Whitey number one said, "He sure goes about it the hard way."
"Ever hear of a substitute?" said Mac.
"You mean like on the bench at football?" Eddie asked.
"Hell no," said Mac. "I mean like a guy is using something to cover up something else, and maybe he don't even know it himself."
Hazel demanded, "You running Doc down?"
"Take it easy," said Mac. "I think Doc's scared to write that paper because he knows it's crazy. Quod erat demonstratum."
"Huh?" asked Fauna.
"QED. said Mac.
"Oh," said Fauna.
"Sure."
Chapter 10. There's a hole in reality through which we can look, if we wish. Doc had made changes. His desk was drawn in front of the window.
He sat writing rapidly on his yellow pad. "Color change," he wrote, "seems to be not only a concentration of fluids to the surface, but also a warping of tissue, which, perhaps, refracts the light, giving an impression of color." A door slammed. Doc looked out at the street. Fauna was teetering down the chicken walk that led from the palace flophouse. Doc looked back at his pad. There were footsteps on the pavement. He looked up. Wide Ida was going toward her bar. Joseph and Mary came out of the heavenly flower and crossed the street, climbed the stairs of Western Biological, and knocked. "Come in," Doc cried, and there was relief in his voice. "Thought I'd shovel the dirt a little. That band of mine is practicing upstairs. Drives me crazy."
"Well, I'm pretty busy," said Doc.
J&M gazed about the room. "Why do you keep snakes?"
"To sell."
"Who'd buy snakes?" said J&M. "Say, what you looking at?"
He craned his neck.
"That's the new dame. She's going to give Fauna trouble. Little Mary trouble."
"Who?"
Doc asked.
"You wasn't listening, I guess."
"I must get to work," said Doc.
"You know, I still don't get it."
"What?"
"There must be some kind of way to kind of bend the odds in chess."
"There isn't. I've got to go."
"What's the rush?"
"Tide," said Doc.
Doc walked on the beach beyond the lighthouse. The waves splashed white beside him and sometimes basted his ankles. The sandpipers ran ahead of him as though on little wheels. The golden afternoon moved on toward China, and on the horizon's edge a lumber schooner balanced. On Doc's left, the white sand dunes rounded up, and behind them the dark pine trees seemed to hold a piece of night throughout the day. Doc thought, under stimulation there is increased pulsing like a man under physical or emotional strain, something like the release of adrenaline, but no way to prove it. No more specimens until spring tides. His middle voice argued, "Maybe you don't believe any of it. Why can't you laugh at yourself? You could once. You're trapped in a cage of self-importance."
"Lonesome," the low voice cried in his guts. "No one to receive from you or give to you. No one warm enough and dear enough."
Doc wanted desperately to go back to his old life, the hopeless wish of a man wanting to be a little boy, forgetting the pain of little boys. Doc dropped to his knees and dug a hole in the damp sand with a scooped hand. He watched the seawater seep in and crumble the sides of the hole. A sand crab scuttled away from his digging fingers. From behind him, a voice said, "What are you digging for?"
"Nothing," said Doc without looking around.
"There are no clams here."
"I know it," said Doc, and his top voice sang. "I just want to be alone. I don't want to talk or explain or argue or even to listen. Now he'll tell me a theory he's got on oceanography. I won't look around."
The voice behind him said, "There's so much metal in the sea. Why, there's enough magnesium in a cubic mile of seawater to pave the whole country." "I always get them," Doc thought. "If there's a bughouser within miles, he's drawn to me."
"I'm a seer," said the voice.
Doc rocked angrily back on his heels.
"Okay,"
he said. It's just my business, but you tell me about it. He didn't remember ever having been discourteous to a stranger before. This one was a big, bearded stranger with the lively, innocent eyes of a healthy baby. He wore ragged overalls and a blue shirt washed nearly white, and he was barefooted. The straw hat on his head had two large holes cut in the brim, proof that it had once been the property of a horse. Doc found his interest rising. "It is my custom to invite a stranger to dinner," said the seer. Not original, of course. Harun al-Rashid did the same. "Please follow me." Doc stood up from his squatting position. The tendons in back of his knees creaked with pain. The seer towered above him, and on closer inspection it was true that his blue eyes had the merry light of a wise baby. But his face was granitic, chiseled out of the material of prophets and patriarchs. Doc found himself wondering if some of the saints had not looked like this. From the ragged sleeves of the blue shirt, wrists like big grapevines protruded, and hands sheathed in brown calluses crisscrossed with barnacle cuts. The seer carried a pair of ancient basketball shoes in his left hand, and seeing Doc look at them, he said, "I only wear them in the sea. My feet aren't proof against urchins and barnacles." In spite of himself, Doc felt surrounded by the man. "Harun," said Doc, "was visited by a genie and the spirits of earth, fire, and water. Do the genie visit you?" Doc thought, "Oh, Lord, am I going to play along with this nonsense? Why can't I cross my fingers and spit and walk away? I can still walk away." The seer looked downward at an angle into Doc's face. "I live alone," he said simply. "I live in the open. I hear the waves at night and see the black patterns of the pine boughs against the sky. With sound and silence and color and solitude, of course I see visions. Anyone would." "But you don't believe in them?" Doc asked hopefully. "I don't find it a matter for belief or disbelief," the seer said. "You've seen the sun flatten and take strange shapes just before it sinks in the ocean. Do you have to tell yourself every time that it's an illusion caused by atmospheric dust and light distorted by the sea? Or do you simply enjoy the beauty of it? Don't you see visions?" "No," said Doc. "From music, don't forms of wishes and forms of memory take shape?"
"That's different," said Doc.
"I don't see any difference," said the seer.
"Come along.
Dinner's ready." In the dunes there are deep little creases where the wind-crouching pines have made a stand against the moving sand, and in one of these, only 100 yards back from the beach, the seer had his home. The little valley was protected from the wind. The pine boughs covered it, and the sand was deeply carpeted with sweet pine needles. Once down in the little cup, you could hear the wind sweeping the pine tips overhead, and a perpetual dusk hung over the warped trees. The pines survived only by following the suggestions of the stronger forces, crouching low and growing their limbs in the direction of the wind, nourishing the little trailing plants which slow up the pace of the walking dunes. Under the trees a fire was burning, and on a hearth of flat stones blackened tin cans steamed. "This is my home," the seer said. "You are welcome here. I have a wonderful dinner." He brought a tin box from the fork of a tree, took out a loaf of French bread,
and sliced off two thick slices. Then he brought sea urchins from a dripping sack, cracked them on a rock, and spread the gonads on the bread. "The males are sweet and the females sour," he said. "I like to mix the two."
"I've tasted them," said Doc. "The Italians eat them. It's about as strong a protein as you can get. Some people think it's aphrodisiac."
There was an iron simplicity in the seer. He was like a monolith of logic standing against waves of angry nonsense.
"Next, we'll have steamed limpets," said the seer. "I have a pin here to eat them with. Do you like sea lettuce?"
"It's an acquired taste. And then I have a stew, a kind of universal bouillabaisse. I won't tell you what's in it. You'll see."
"Do you take all your food from the sea?"
The seer smiled at him.
"No, not all. I wish I could. It would be simpler. I take all the protein I need, and more, but my human stomach still craves starch. I want a little bread and some potatoes. I love acid with the protein. See, I have a bottle of vinegar and some lemons. And last, I indulge myself with herbs, rosemary and thyme and sage and marjoram."
"How about sugars?" Doc asked. "You won't find sugars in a tide pool."
The seer dropped his eyes and watched a black ant try to climb an avalanche of sand, losing ground all the way. When he spoke, his voice was shy and ashamed.
"I steal candy bars," he said. "I can't seem to help it."
"The flesh is weak," said Doc.
"Oh, I don't mind that," the seer cried. "Appetites are good things. The more appetites a man has, the richer he is. But I was taught not to steal. I don't believe in stealing. It hurts my feelings when I do, and I don't enjoy the candy bars as much as I would if I didn't steal them. But I love Baby Ruth's and Mounds."
They picked the limpets from their shells with pins and dipped them in lemon juice. The stew contained mussels and clams and crabs and little fish seasoned with garlic and rosemary.
"Some people don't like it," said the seer. After they had finished, Doc lay back in the pine needles, and a fine peacefulness settled on him. The air, the softness of the needles, the odors of kelp and pine and yerba buena, the music of surf against wind-plucking pine needles, the fullness of belly, made a little room of contentment around him. He said,
"I'm surprised they don't lock you up."
"A reasonable man. It's one of the symptoms of our time to find danger in men like you who don't worry and rush about. Particularly dangerous are men who don't think the world's coming to an end."
"It's coming to an end, all right," the seer said. "That started the moment it was born."
"I don't know why they don't put you in jail. It's a crime to be happy without equipment."
"Oh, they do," said the seer. "And they put me under observation every once in a while."
"I forgot," said Doc. "You are crazy, aren't you?"
"I guess so," said the seer, "but not dangerous. And they've never caught me stealing candy bars. I'm very clever at that, and I steal only one at a time."
"Don't ever gather disciples," said Doc. "They'd have you on a cross in no time."
"There's not much danger of that. I don't teach anybody anything."
"I'm not so sure," said Doc. "The doctrine of our time is that man can't get along without a whole hell of a lot of stuff. You may not be preaching it, but you're living treason."
"I'm lazy," said the seer. "Did you ever drink yerba buena tea?"
"No." It's strong and aromatic and mildly physic. Can you drink it out of a beer bottle?
I don't know why not.
Look out. The bottle's hot. Here, wrap a twig around it.
After a while, the seer asked, What's aching you? Or don't you want to talk about it?
I'd just as soon talk about it if I knew what it was, said Doc. As a matter of fact, it's gone away for the moment.
Ah, one of those, said the seer. Do you have wife or children?
No.
Do you want wife or children?
I don't think so.
The seer said, I saw a mermaid last night. You remember there was a half moon and a thin drifting mist. There was color in the night, not like the black and gray and white of an ordinary night. Down at the end of the beach, a shelf of rock reaches out, and the tide was low so that there was a smooth bed of kelp. She swam to the edge and then churned her tail like a salmon leaping a rapid. And then she lay on the kelp bed and made dancing figures with her white arms and hands. She didn't go away until the rising tide covered the kelp bed.
Was she a dream? Did you imagine her?
I don't know.
But if I did, I'm proud that I could imagine anything so beautiful.
What is it you want?
I've tried to think, said Doc. I want to take everything I've seen and thought and learned and reduce them and relate them and refine them until I have something of meaning, something of use, and I can't seem to do it.
Maybe you aren't ready, and maybe you need help.
What kind of help?
There are some things a man can't do alone. I wouldn't think of trying anything so big without...
He stopped. The heavy waves beat the hard beach, and the yellow light of the setting sun illuminated a cloud to the eastward, a clot of gold.
Without what? Doc asked.
Without love, said the seer. I have to go the sunset now. I've come to the point where I don't think it can go down without me. That makes me seem needed. He stood up and brushed the pine needles from his threadbare overalls.
I'll come to see you again, said Doc.
I might be gone, the seer replied. I've got a restlessness in me. I'll probably be gone. Doc watched him trudge over the brim of the dune and saw the wind flip up the brim of his straw hat and the yellow sun light up his face and glisten in his beard.
Chapter 11. Hazel's Brooding. After Mac left the palace flophouse, and incidentally did not find Doc at home, Hazel sat brooding. Things came through slowly to Hazel. He had heard Mac advance his theory about how Doc would never get his paper written, but the impact of the statement did not strike home until he was alone. It is true that all over Cannery Row the feeling was growing that Doc was not infallible. But the news had not seeped through to Hazel. He knew that Doc was in trouble, but the friendly feeling of contempt had not penetrated. If Doc had wanted to know the hour and the day of the world's demise, he would have gone to Doc, and Doc's answer would have been final. Alone, he brooded, not about Doc's weakness, but about the treachery of Doc's friends who could question him. Who would dare to question him? Hazel beat his hand on the arm of his rocking chair for a while, and then he got up and went to Wide Ida's. Eddie was behind the bar, so Hazel had two shots of whiskey and paid for a Coke.
He walked between two canneries to the beach. A seagull with a broken wing engaged his kindly interest. He chased it, trying to help it, until it swam to sea and drowned. Hazel had experienced an earthquake, and he searched for the shaker. He walked along the rocks to Pacific Grove Beach, and even the brown young men standing on their hands for the girls did not hold interest. He went up the hill and toured the basement of Holman's department store. The floor manager accompanied him, an honor and a precaution few people received. But Hazel didn't even see the shining display of small tools. You cannot cut the ground from under a man and expect him to act normally. On his way back to Cannery Row, Hazel passed a funeral home where an impressive group was gathering. Ordinarily, Hazel would have joined any kind of celebration with enthusiasm, but now he watched the mounds of gladiolas being carried out, and no sense of participation stirred in him. The festive dead would have to be buried without Hazel. In New Monterey, Hazel walked not around, but right through a dogfight. All the preceding manifestations would have troubled his friends, but if they had known what Hazel was thinking, they would have been horrified. Thinking is always painful, but in Hazel, it was heroic. A picture of the process would make you seasick. A gray, whirling furor of images, memories, words, patterns. It was like a traffic jam at a big intersection, with Hazel in the middle, trying to get something to move somewhere. He strolled back to Cannery Row, but he did not go to the Palace Flophouse. By instinct, he crept under the branches of the black cypress tree in the vacant lot where he had lived for so many years in pre-palace days. Hazel's thoughts were not complicated. It was just remarkable that he had them at all. Hazel loved Doc. Doc was in trouble. Somebody was responsible. Who? That it might be a situation rather than a person was beyond his grasp. The person who was hurting Doc must be made to stop it, even if he had to be killed. Hazel had nothing against murder. That he hadn't killed anybody was only because he hadn't needed to or wanted to. He tried to recall everything he had heard concerning Doc's frustration, and was all nebulous, all vague, except for one thing. Mac had said Doc couldn't write his paper. That was the only clear statement that had been made. Mac was the one. If Mac knew about it, he must be responsible for it. This was a matter of sorrow to Hazel, because he liked Mac very much. He hoped he wouldn't have to kill him. It was getting dark under the cypress tree, too dark to read. Hazel always judged light by whether or not you could read by it, in spite of the fact that he never read anything. The front porch light of the Bear Flag came on. Western Biological was still dark. Up the hill in the Palace Flophouse, the kerosene lantern made a dim glow through the windows. Again and again, Hazel tried to turn to sweet thoughtlessness, but it was no use. Mac was responsible. Mac had to do something about it. Hazel got up and brushed the cypress dirt from his clothes. He walked up past the rusty pipes and the empty boiler, crossed the railroad track, and went up the chicken walk. Behind him, muffled by the canneries, he could hear Cacahuete playing Stormy Weather on his trumpet and the sea lions on China Point barking. In the palace, Mac and the boys were playing tic-tac-toe with a piece of chalk on the floor. The whining jug was set conveniently near. "Hi, Hazel," said Mac. "Draw up." "Mac,"
Hazel said sadly. I want you should step outside with me and put up your dukes.
Mac rocked back on his heels. What?
I'm going to beat the holy hell out of you, said Hazel.
Why?
Mac asked. This was just the question Hazel was afraid of. He tried to find a quick, tough answer.
You just step out and you'll find out, he said.
Hazel, Mac stood up. Hazel, baby, what's eating you? Tell me. See if I can't make it right. Hazel felt the whole situation leaving his hands.
You can't treat Doc that way, he said fiercely. Not Doc.
What way am I treating him? I ain't done nothing to Doc, except maybe hustle him a little. But we all done that. Even you tried.
You said he can't write his paper, that's what you done.
Oh, for God's sake, said Mac.
You're yellow, then.
Okay, I'm yellow. Sometime when I ain't feeling yellow, I'll paddywhack you. Sit down. Have a jolt from the jug.
They babied Hazel and pampered him until his eyes were damp with appreciation. But when Hazel's mind dug in, it would not let loose.
You got to help him, he repeated. He ain't happy. He just mopes. You got to help him.
Mac said, it ain't entirely our fault. Trouble is, Doc lets concealment like a worm in the bud feed on his damask cheek.
He sure as hell does, said Whitey number two.
I ain't going to stand for no excuses, said Hazel.
Mac studied the problem from every angle. Hazel's right, he said at last. We've been selfish. We never in our lives had such a good friend as Doc, and we're letting him down. Makes me feel ashamed. It's Hazel showed the way. If I was in trouble, I wouldn't want Hazel to do no figuring, but I sure would like to have him for a friend.
Hazel ducked his head in embarrassment. In his life, so few compliments had come his way that he didn't know how to cope with them.
Mac went on. I make a solemn move. We all stand up and drink a toast to Hazel. A noble, noble soul.
Oh. Hell, fellas, said Hazel, and he wiped his eyes on his sleeve. They stood in a circle around him, Mac, Nettie, Whitey number one, Whitey number two, and each one tipped the jug over his elbow and drank to Hazel. Good feeling was running so high they did it again, and were about to do it a third time when Hazel said, ain't there something we can drink to so I can get a drink?
To Lefty Grove, said Eddie. That broke the ice. An era of good feeling set in. They dug up another keg of the private stock Eddie had saved during the war. He started the bung and smelled it delicately.
I remember this one, he said. They was some guys up from South America, and they brought in a bottle of absinthe.
Perfumes the whole house, said Mac. It was like old times, they reminded one another, if Gay were only here. Let's drink a toast to good old Gay, our departed friend. The absinthe had soothed the mixture in the keg and added something sweet and old-fashioned. A courtliness crept into the speech of the dwellers of the palace flophouse, an old-world courtesy. Everyone vied to be last, not first, at the refilled jug.
Next dough we get, we'll go up to Woolworth's and get some glasses, said Mac.
Hell, said Whitey number two, they'll just get broke, but I see what you mean. Somehow they felt they were living in a moment when history pauses and takes stock and changes course. They knew they would look back on this night as a beginning.
At such times men feel the nudge toward oratory. Mac steadied himself against the stove and begged their attention by rapping on the stovepipe.
"Gentlemen," he said, "let us here highly resolve to get Doc's ass out of the sling of despond."
Eddie said, "Remember we done something like that once and damn near ruined him?"
Mac's golden mood held.
"We were younger then," he said. "This time, we're going to think her out, and she's going to be foolproof."
Hazel was so far won back into comradeship that he had relaxed into happy incoherence.
"To Lefty Grove," he said.
Mac opened the oven door and sat on it.
"I've given it a lot of thought," he said. "Lately I done hardly nothing else."
"You never do hardly nothing else," said Whitey number two. Mac ignored him.
"I got a theory."
"Ah, shut up," said Eddie.
"Who are you talking to?" said Whitey number two.
"I don't know," said Eddie innocently, "but if the shoe fits..."
"I got a theory, if you ain't too pie-eyed to listen," said Mac.
When he had them quiet, he went on. "When you hear my theory, you might get kind of violent. I want you to sleep on it before you talk. I think Doc needs a wife."
"What? Well, hell, he don't have to marry her," said Mac. "You know what I mean."
If the absinthe had not given them tolerance, he might have had a series of fights right then.
"Kindly do not interrupt," he said. "I will now review the dame situation in the U.S. You take a look at divorces and the reasons for them, and you can only think one thing. The only guy that shouldn't have nothing to do with picking out a wife is the guy that's going to marry her. That's fact. It's a fact that if he's left alone, a guy practically always marries the wrong kind of dame."
"Play it safe and don't marry nobody," said Whitey number two.
"There's some guys can't operate that way," said Mac.
"Are you suggesting we turn Doc, our true friend, in?"
"I asked you not to shoot off your face until you slept on it," said Mac with dignity.
Hazel tugged at his sleeve.
"Ain't you joking, Mac?"
"No," said Mac. "I ain't joking. If anything bad comes to Doc, you know what I'd do to you?"
Hazel asked.
"Yes," said Mac. "I think I do. And I think I'd have it coming."
Hazel's bed was a four-poster on which the bedposts were 2x4s topped by a quilt. He had built it from memory of a moving picture. When the palace flophouse was quiet at last, Hazel lay in his bed and looked up at the log cabin pattern of his canopy. His mind was whirling. He wished there were some simpler way to help Doc than by the major operation Mac had suggested. Once he got up and looked out the door and saw that the green-shaded light was on in the laboratory.
"The poor bastard," he whispered.
He didn't sleep well, and his dreams were shaped like mushrooms.
Chapter 12. Flower in a Crannied Wall. Joe Elegant was a pale young man with bangs. He smoked foreign cigarettes in a long ebony holder, and he cooked for the Bear Flag. The girls said he made the best popovers in the world, and he could give a massage that would shake the kinks out of a Saturday night when the fleet was in. He sneered most of the time, and except at mealtime kept to himself in his little lean-to behind the Bear Flag, from which the rattle of his typewriter could be heard late at night.
One morning, soon after she had come, Susie was having her coffee while Joe Elegant cleared the table of crumbs from earlier breakfasts.
"You make good coffee," Susie said.
"Thank you."
"You don't look like a guy who would work here."
"It's temporary, I assure you."
"I got a wonderful recipe for gumbo. Want me to give it to you?"
"Fauna designs the meals."
"You ain't very friendly."
"Why should I be?"
He was passing behind her. Susie reached up, hooked her fingers in his shirt collar, twisted and yanked his face down level with her own.
"Listen, you," she began, and she scowled into his popping eyes.
"Oh, the hell with it," said Susie, and released him.
Joe Elegant stepped back and massaged his throat and smoothed his shirt.
"Sorry," said Susie.
"It's quite all right."
"What makes you so mean?"
"You said it. I don't belong here."
"Where do you belong?"
"I don't think you'd understand."
"You too good for the place?"
"Let's say I'm different."
"No kidding," said Susie.
"I'm writing a novel."
"You are? What about? I love novels."
"You wouldn't like this one."
"Why not?"
"You wouldn't understand it."
"Then what good is it?"
"It isn't intended for the mass."
"I'm the mass, huh? I guess you got something there. I bet you could write a pretty nice hunk of stuff."
Joe Elegant swallowed, and his face twitched convulsively.
"Sometime I'll read you some of it."
"Say, that'd be nice, but you said I couldn't understand it."
"I'll explain it as I go along."
"I'd like that. There's one whole hell of a lot I don't understand."
"Do you like brownies?" he asked.
"I love them."
"I'll make you some.
Maybe you'll come to my apartment some afternoon. I could give you a cup of tea."
"Say, you're a nice fella. Got any more coffee?"
"I'll make a fresh pot."
Chapter 13. Parallels Must Be Related. Doc spent a restless night. His head was full of yellow pads and sears and octopi. Ordinarily he would have worked or read since he couldn't sleep, but now if he turned on a light he would see the yellow pad and the marshaled pencils. As the dawn crept over the bay, he decided to go for a very long walk, perhaps to follow the shoreline all the way around to Carmel. He arose, and since it was still dusky in the laboratory, he turned on the lights to make his coffee. Wide Ida, from the entrance of La Ida, saw his lights come on. She put an unlabeled pint bottle of brown liquor in a paper bag and crossed the street to Western Biological.
"Doc," she said, "would you work this stuff over?"
"What is it?"
"They say it's whiskey. I just want to know if it'll kill anybody. I got a pretty good buy. They make it up in Pine Canyon."
"That's against the law," said Doc.
"Killing people is against the law, too," said Wide Ida.
Doc was torn between bootlegging and murder. He thought sadly that he was always involved in something like this. Not good or bad, but bad and less bad. He made a fairly quick analysis.
"It's not poison," he said, "but it won't build good, healthy stomachs. There's some fusel oil in it, and I guess it's no worse than old tennis shoes."
"Thanks, Doc. What do I owe you?"
"Oh, maybe a quart, but not this stuff."
"I'll send over some old Taylor."
"Oh, you don't have to go off the deep end," said Doc.
"Doc, I hear you got trouble."
"Me? What kind of trouble?"
"I just heard," said Wide Ida.
Doc said angrily. I've got no trouble. What's all the talk? God almighty, everybody treats me as though I had a disease. What kind of trouble?
If there's anything I can do, she said, went out quickly, leaving the pint behind. Doc took a sip of it, made a face, and took a swig. His heart was pounding angrily. He could not admit that the pity of his friends only confirmed his frustration. He knew that pity and contempt are brothers. He set his chin.
I will get the spring tides at La Jolla, he said to himself. I will get a new microscope.
And the very lowest voice whispered, somewhere there's warmth. He sat down at his desk and wrote viciously, parallels must be related. He took another drink from the pint and opened yesterday's mail. There was an order for 6 sets of slides, Starfish, embryonic series, for the Oakland Polytechnic High School. He was almost glad to do the old and practiced work. He got his collecting buckets together, threw rubber boots in his old car, and drove out to the great tide pool. Chapter 14. Lousy Wednesday. Some days are born ugly. From the very first light, they're no damn good whatever, the weather, and everybody knows it. No one knows what causes this, but on such a day, people resist getting out of bed and set their heels against the day. When they're finally forced out by hunger or job, they find that the day is just as lousy as they knew it would be. On such a day, it's impossible to make a good cup of coffee. Shoestrings break. Cups leap from the shelf by themselves and shatter on the floor. Children, ordinarily honest, tell lies. And children, ordinarily good, unscrew the tap handles of the gas range and lose the screws and have to be spanked. This is the day the cat chooses to have kittens, and housebroken dogs wet on the parlor rug. Oh, it's awful on such a day. The postman brings overdue bills. If it's a sunny day, it's too damn sunny, and if it's dark, who can stand it? Mac knew it was going to be that kind of day. He couldn't find his pants. He fell over a box that had crept out in his path. He cursed each brother in the palace flophouse, and on his way across the vacant lot, he went out of his way to kick a dandelion flower. He was sitting gloomily on a pipe when Eddie came by, and so naturally he walked with Eddie to Wide Ida's to try to do something about it. He hung around waiting for Wide Ida to go so that Eddie could slip him a drink, but Wide Ida was bending over the bar, cursing a letter. Taxes, she said. Every time you get going, there's more taxes. You're lucky, Mac. You don't owe nothing. You don't make nothing. Until they start taxing skin, you're safe. What's the beef? Mac asked. City and county taxes, said Wide Ida. On what? On this place. It ain't much, but I was fixed to put a down payment on a new Pontiac. It was a statement that ordinarily would have aroused a detached compassion in Mac, together with mild self-congratulation that he was not burdened with taxable assets. But now a nagging worry fell on him, and he went back to the palace flophouse to worry in greater comfort. He went over the history of the palace in his mind. It had belonged to Lee Chong. Long before the war, Mac and the boys had rented it from him for $5 a month, and, naturally enough, they had never paid any rent. Lee Chong would have been shocked if they had. Then Lee Chong sold out to Joseph and Mary. Did the palace go with the rest? Mac didn't know, but if it did, the patron didn't know it. He was no Lee Chong.
he would have demanded the rent. But if the patron did own the place, he would get a tax bill. If he got a tax bill, he was sure to be on the necks of Mac and the boys. The patron was not a man to pay out money without getting more money back. That was certain. It seemed very unjust. Their home, their security, even their social standing were cast in the balance. Mac lay on his bed and considered what could be done. Suppose the patron demanded back rent, clear back for years. You couldn't trust a man like that. What a lousy day it was. Mac didn't know what to do, so he called a meeting of the boys. He even sent Hazel to bring Eddie back from White Ida's bar. It was a grim and shaken assembly. Mac explained all the angles until even Hazel seemed to understand the danger. The boys studied their fingers, looked at the ceiling, blew on their knuckles. Eddie got up and walked around his chair to change his thinking luck. At last, Whitey number two said, "We could steal his mail so he won't get no tax bill." "It ain't practical," said Mac, "even if it wasn't a crime." Hazel offered, "We could kill him." "You ain't heard that's against the law, too?" Mac asked.
"I mean, make it like an accident," said Hazel. "He could fall off Point Lobos.
Then somebody else inherits the joint, and we don't even know who." The injustice in the theory of private ownership of real estate was descending on them.
"Maybe we could get Doc to talk to him. He likes Doc."
This was Whitey number one's offering. "That would only draw it to his attention," said Mac. "Hell, he might even raise the rent."
"He might even try to collect it," said Eddie.
Hazel was going into a slow but luminous burn. He gazed about the whitewashed walls of the Palace Flophouse, at the Coca-Cola calendar girls, at the great and ancient wood stove, at the grandfather clock, at the framed portrait of Romy Jacks. There were honest, unabashed tears in Hazel's eyes.
"The son of a bitch," he said. "After all our work, he takes away our home. The only place where I ever been happy. How can a guy be so goddamn mean?"
"He ain't done it yet," said Mac. "He don't even know about it, maybe."
"I wish Doc owned the palace," said Eddie. "We wouldn't have no trouble with Doc."
Mac looked at him quickly.
"What put that in your head?" he demanded.
"Hell, Doc don't open his mail for weeks on end. Doc would forget to collect the rent, and he'd forget to open a tax bill."
Excitement shone in Mac's eyes. "Eddie," he said, "maybe you put your finger in it."
"In what?"
"I got to think it over," said Mac. "But just maybe our darling Eddie here is a genius."
Eddie blushed with pleasure.
"What'd I do, Mac?"
"I can't tell you now."
"Hell, Mac, I want to know what I done."
"It was smart," said Mac. "It was a stroke of just pure wonderful. Now let's give the patron a going over. How much guts you think he's got?"
"Plenty," said Hazel. "And he's plenty wise."
Mac spoke slowly, thinking aloud. "Let's see. Joseph and Mary, you might say, is a con man in a general kind of way."
"He's a nice dresser," said Hazel.
"A con man can't make enemies unless, of course, he wants to get out of town. He gotta keep everybody happy and friendly."
"Come on, Mac," Whitey number one demanded. "Tell us."
"Fellas," said Mac, "if I blowed it now and it was no good, why, you'd kind of lose face in me. I want to think this one out and see if I can't kind of surround him. If we do her, you'll all have to help."
"Do what?"
"Let me alone now, boys," said Mac.
and he went back to his bed and put his head on his crossed hands and studied the rafters of the palace flophouse. Hazel came quietly to his bedside.
"You won't let nobody take our home away, will you, Mac?"
"I promise," said Mac fervently. "Where's Eddie?"
"Went back to White Ida's."
"Will you do something for me, Hazel?"
"Sure, Mac.
Take that lard can over there and see can Eddie fill it full of beer without too much fuss. It'll help me to think better."
"You'll get your beer," said Hazel. "You just keep thinking, Mac."
"Say, Mac, how do you think Eddie always got a stroke of genius, even when he don't know it, and I don't never have none?"
"Come again?" said Mac.
"How come?"
"Oh, the hell with it," said Hazel.
Chapter 15. The Plain Fields of Harrow. Fauna had made a success of three improbable enterprises. More than likely she could have held her own in steel or chemicals, maybe even in General Electric, for Fauna had the proper ingredients for modern business. She was benevolent and at the same time solvent, public-spirited and privately an individualist, open-handed but with a delicate sense of double-entry bookkeeping, sentimental but not soft. She could easily have been chairman of the board of a large corporation, and Fauna took a deep personal interest in her girls. Shortly after she took over the Bear flag, Fauna set aside and decorated the Ready Room. It was a large and pleasant apartment with three windows overlooking the vacant lot. Fauna put in deep chairs and couches covered with bright, flower-littered glazed chintz. The drapes matched the furniture, and the pictures were designed to soothe without arousing interest. Engravings of cows in ponds, deer in streams, dogs in lakes. Wet animals seemed to serve some human need. For recreation, Fauna provided a table tennis set, a card table, and a parcheesi board. The Ready Room was a place to relax, to read, to gossip, to study, and some of these things were actually done by the girls of the Bear flag. One wall was dominated by a large framed board on which were pasted enormous gold stars, and this was Fauna's personal pride. The Ready Room was gay and feminine. It had an exotic oriental odor from the incense which burned in the blackened lap of a crouching plaster Buddha. At about 2:45, Agnes and Mabel and Becky were relaxing in the Ready Room. It was a time of languor. The vacant lot was washed in a clear pale sunshine, which made even the rusty pipes and the old boiler look beautiful. The tall mallow weeds were as sweetly green as a garden. A sleek gray lazy Persian cat hunted gophers in the grass and didn't care whether she caught one or not. Mabel stood at the window. She said, "I heard some people used to live in that old boiler." Agnes was painting her toenails and waving her feet to dry the enamel.
"That was before your time," she said. "Mr. and Mrs. Malloy, they had it fixed up nice. Awning out front, oriental rug. Once you got inside, through the fryer door, it was real nice. She was a homemaker."
"Why'd they leave?" Becky asked.
"They got to arguing. She kept wanting curtains. He wouldn't let her because there wasn't no windows. When they argued, it kind of echoed in there and got on their nerves. He said there wasn't room inside to take a swing at her. He's in the county jail now. Trusty. Mrs. Malloy slinging hash in a grease joint over in Salinas, waiting for him to get out. They was real nice people. He's a high elk."
Mabel moved away from the window. "You heard the Rattlesnake Club is coming from Salinas tonight. Took the whole house over."
"Yeah," said Becky.
They're having a memorial meeting for dead members. Fauna gave them a rate.
Agnes lifted her left leg and blew on her toenails.
Like this color?
She asked.
It's nice, said Becky. Looks a little like you was rotting.